Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is a special episode for June 2017, where we talk about healthcare in Europe mostly. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. The Phileas Club is, as most of you know, I'm sure, a show where we get people from different parts of the world and different cultures, different countries, to get together and talk about what's been happening in the world in the past month or so. That's the regular episodes we do, and they're fascinating. You should go and listen to those, too. But for this one, we're going to be doing a special, and specials are where we have a one-on-one, usually, conversation about a specific topic. It might be life in a country that many of us are not familiar with, or a kind of political leaning that we're not experiencing in our daily life, or all of these kinds of specific topics that we like to cover to explore. I almost said alternative, but it's not alternative viewpoints. It's really just other viewpoints that we might not be exposed to often. And in this one, we're going to be talking a little bit more about healthcare, specifically in Europe. And I'm going to get into why in just a minute, why I decided to do this episode. But first, let me introduce, well, I guess myself. My name is Patrick Beja. I live in France and Finland. And my guest today is Bruce Woodward, who has an interesting story and history. You were in Zimbabwe, and now you're in the UK, in Scotland. Yeah. How are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Patrick.
So before I get into why, how, when, all of this for this show, can you tell us just a couple of words about yourself to situate the listeners?
I work in healthcare. I actually work for a council in Scotland. I live in Scotland. I used to live in Zimbabwe. I've been living in Scotland for about 4 or 5 years now, and I currently work in health and social care. So I've got a bit of an understanding, and I had a similar reaction to many people, I think, to your
previous episode.
Previous episode, yes. So.
So, yeah, let me tell you a little bit the thought process I went through to when I decided to do this one. We did talk about healthcare in the previous episode. It wasn't the only topic of conversation, but we did address it quite in a lengthy segment. And it was with the presence of a couple of my conservative friends who gave their opinion on the healthcare and their views on that question. I hesitate to say issue because it shouldn't be an issue really, but it turns out it is in many countries and not just the US. And we did get a lot of feedback on that episode. A lot of the feedback was, I don't want to say negative in the sense that people thought it was a bad episode, but I think a lot of people were frustrated with how we discussed healthcare. And there was definitely a underlying current of people thinking that we didn't explain healthcare and that we should have, expert understandings on why healthcare works the way it does and how the Affordable Care Act by the Obama presidency didn't work out the way it should have initially because of certain parties blocking this and that aspect of it. And I have to say, there were a few people who were understanding of the position of the conservative part of the show. But mostly it was people frustrated of the inaccuracies that were relayed. And I think I did try and call on some of those inaccuracies. Some of them I don't know well enough, of course, to detail everything. But it did lead me to think and reemphasize the fact that this show and the previous episode is not about trying to explain healthcare or convince people that think that way or the other that, you know, healthcare is good or bad or should work like this or that. I'm not going to start making this episode, making this show into here is the definitive word on that issue that is common and very divisive for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm not ashamed to say I don't have the expertise in, you know, 15 million topics that we're going to cover. And I can't, it's, you know, it's impossible to do that. And there are many, many avenues and venues and outlets that will do this in a much better way, with the caveat that at that point you jump into, well, this one is liberal slanted, this one is conservative slanted, and it's impossible. What people think is the definitive word is only going to be the definitive word for their political leanings or their opinion on that specific matter. So I really don't think this show should become, now we're going to explain why you're wrong, right? And this is inevitably what the conversation turns into if you try to explain these things in a definitive, objective, quote-unquote, manner. And it's not to say that this shouldn't happen. Of course, I think there are issues, and many of them, and healthcare is one of them, I think, where the judgment should be pretty clear. It isn't, but it really should be, unlike many other divisive topics. But there are other places, other people that would do that a lot better than I would. So I really want to focus the core of this show on listening to people's opinion. This is really what this show is about. When I ask someone what they think of Donald Trump, of course, I'm going to say what I think as well, but the goal is not to convince them that they're wrong. The goal is to hear what they have to say to help me form my opinion on that topic that we're discussing. I'm talking about Donald Trump because I think what happened with the previous episode was really interesting because it mirrors what happened with the Brexit conversation and the Donald Trump conversations, where I felt after the fact, you know what, we were a little bit slanted to one side. And, you know, the fact that we're slanted doesn't really matter. We all are. But I felt like we didn't hear the opinion on of the other side. And we didn't understand it. Even more important than hearing it, we didn't understand it. So that's why in the previous, year, 18 months, I've done episodes trying to give voice to that other side. And I think it was absolutely fair. And it did allow me, and hopefully you, the listeners, to understand a little bit more of what was happening in those instances. And I really think it provided that service in those cases. And the reason I'm saying it mirrors things today is that in the case of the previous episode, we talked about healthcare in a way that I think was a little bit slanted as well. But then on the other side, I'm very much on the liberal side, but I think the overarching tone of the episode ended up being on the side of the conservative view. And the reasons why I was contesting, but I don't think we didn't quite show why I think healthcare is important and works. We're not going to explain it again, and we're not going to go into, you know, oh, but the Canadians actually don't go to the U.S. for this or that, and there's some, you know, high-level healthcare that works well, and if you want to get care for specialized procedures, you can do that faster in the U.S., or that's not what we're going to get into. I think we're going to get into what our experience in Europe is of healthcare, so that maybe we dispel a few myths that Americans and some others have about healthcare. But that's not the goal. The goal is to tell the listeners what how we experience healthcare in the real world. That's the great aspect of this show, that we talk to real people, not journalists, politicians, you know, whatever. We get the feeling from the ground. So hopefully, I mean, that's, I think, actually a tall order. We'll see if we manage to do it. But I hope we at least manage to give listeners a glimpse into how it works for us. So, all right, that was a long introduction. But I think it was necessary. And I'm not exactly sure how we're going to approach it, but we're going to try. And let's start with giving the talking stick back to Bruce. And can you tell us a little bit how, you know, you experience healthcare where you live, with the good and the bad and you know, all of it?
I think before I go into it, I just want to say three things I've sure. noted while you're talking there. One is, I think it's very important not to fact check people hard, and you know, this is not a fact check, and I'm not, you know, what the guy said on the last podcast is not wrong, it's their experience, so I definitely agree with that. And that's the second thing, is, you know, I feel like they're not seeing the whole picture. You really need to have a look and experience how life is in different places to really, really understand what it's like. And the third thing is just a small note on what I do. I'm a statistician. I do numbers and stats, and I'm not going to present them here. I thought about bringing all sorts of numbers, but that's not the point here.
Feel free to throw in one or two here and there.
I could do, yeah. I mean, I can give a few headline things, but I'm not an expert on delivery, and even within my team, the area I work in, there's debates within the experts of how to deliver healthcare, and there are moral issues around where the money should go. And you know, that's a big question in itself. So I think what I will speak about is the overarching figure of, I think the Americans call it single payer, but it's what we in the UK have is the NHS, the National Health Service, which obviously was founded back in 1948, I think it's the year my dad was born. So 48 or 47. So, and that was set up with the view that anyone who needs healthcare can get it. And it'll be the best quality that is available to the system, and it is a basic human right for people to get healthcare. Now, that was it's a very moral standpoint, and I think it's something that people after the Second World War felt was needed. It's not a hippie liberal love thing; it's a basic fact to say, look, let's take care of each other, instead of the horrors of World War II, when a whole bunch of things happened that I don't think I could even imagine, and I don't think many other people can even imagine in the first world today, at least. So, I'm going to address the broader things, and I guess I'm going to start with my story. I was born in Zimbabwe to a British father and an Italian mother who'd basically immigrated out there. I was born in the late 70s and just at the time of independence. And it's a lot of these things I'm realizing now, and I'm not meaning them as pejoratives when I say certain things, but I realize I've changed since then. So I grew up into a very conservative society. It was very strict in the schools I went to were very much British boarding schools, except I wasn't a boarder myself. And we'd have uniforms and we'd have prefects and we had head boys who did this and that. And you couldn't walk on this lawn, you couldn't walk on that lawn. And there was a very strict structure in in who you spoke to and how you spoke to them. And, you know, there was no calling teachers by first name. It was Mr. Milne and Mr. That and Mrs. That and all that. It was very, very much that.
That I'm all in favor for. In favor of. I mean, calling teachers by their first name. I know they do that in liberal Scandinavia, which honestly, that's taking it too far. But anyway, sorry, please continue.
It's an interesting thing because that carries on into the workplace in Zimbabwe. I know I was a young man of the early 20s. It was probably, I was in 18, 19 when I started working for my father, and I had 40, 50-year-old guys calling me Mr. Woodward. and I found that very strange. But and then I went from there to working in a school in the UK and having people call me by my first name, you know, students call me by my first name. So it's a very strange dichotomy. But Mr. Bejar, that's fine. I'll call you that from now on. I think it was very conservative. And anyone who's listened to the podcast where we had Bongai on a few
right,
episodes
ago. Zimbabwe special, a few episodes Zimbabwe back. Special, go listen to that too.
If you don't mind me doing that, but I think one of the realizations I had there, and it's I've had it for a long time, is that I had a very, I guess it was a sort of protected upbringing. And in that protected bubble, it was very easy for me to look outside and say, you know what, those people, they're just not working hard enough for what they have. Look at me. I go to school, I get good grades, not really seeing that I am having somebody pick up after me. I'm having somebody pick me up from school and drop me off every day. I'm having a full meal in my belly every night. In fact, that's probably why you won't see me on video right now, because I'm a bit... but, you know, I've... there was a lot of things that I realized only looking back that, wow, I was quite privileged. And I keep using that word, and I don't want to use it in the, I started calling them alt-left sense of the word, where people go overboard too far to the left. But
what do you mean by that?
I think
like alt-left people going like, oh, check your privilege. And
yeah. You know, when you go too, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's people who go too far. It's sort of like, you know, let's all be humans. And one of the things I've learned is going to extremes is a bad thing. I think any extreme is a bad thing. You know, if you find yourself hard line, then you need to sort of have a look around you, look back. And that's why I've been so invested in the Phileas Club. I think it's, I think it's a great experiment. It's a great experiment what you're doing. It's a great piece of
thank you Mr. Woodward.
Journalism. I don't know what you want to, it is journalism, isn't it?
I guess maybe I don't feel I've earned the right to call this journalism, you know. I don't have the kind of work ethics, I think, that would, anyway, that's another conversation. So
I grew up in that bubble, and then I swore I'd never leave Zimbabwe, and I left in the early 2000s because being it was very strange being the minority in the country. Went from the reality suddenly hit once the political situation changed, and while there were a lot of atrocities, there's a lot of sense in what happened in Zimbabwe on the ground, in that there were injustices done for years and years and years, and there were promises made that weren't fulfilled. And me, as a single white man, went from being you'll get a job anywhere, you'll get paid, you'll get a lovely, you know, lovely house, etc., to actually you're part of the minority now. We've recognized that, and we're going to give other people a chance before you. And at the time, I saw it as a, I don't want to get in too much into the politics there, but I saw it as very much an injustice against me. I see it now as not really as being so much that. I think there were different ways I could have tackled it. But I was lucky enough to have a British passport, so I came to the UK and started working.
Let me interrupt for just a second, to mention that this is interesting because it echoes a lot of what's happening in the U.S. As well. Mm-hmm. I hope people listening to this don't take it as, oh, now they're lecturing us about inequality and injustice in the U.S.
No.
Right? That's not... This is just Bruce, and we didn't rehearse this or talk about it specifically before. The way I understand it, this is Bruce telling you his experience. So take it as you want. If you want to think that, oh, this is, you know, liberal BS, or like, of course he's going to think that because that's how what he went through, you're free to do that, of course. But it's still, you know, the experience of a real person who went through something. So I think we should really take it as this testimony of someone's actual life. So sorry, keep going.
No, carry on. I don't mind. And just on the back of that, if anyone wants to chat to me or debate anything, I'm quite happy to, and I'll give you my details afterwards. You've got my Twitter handle, etc. So I'm willing to be challenged, just like you are, and I think it's healthy to be challenged and healthy to discuss. So I've come to where I am from doing that. So who knows, you know, could look back in a year and say, what the hell was I thinking? I was completely wrong.
So you moved to the UK.
I moved to the UK, and that's where things started to change for me, because I suddenly saw that I started working as a support assistant in schools as a special needs teacher. And I'd always prescribed to this belief that the system in the UK was too liberal, that, you know, all these people getting benefits and, you know, off the hardworking taxpayers' money, et cetera, and you know, it's not fair, and, you know, they should work for what they, you know, this is always the conservative view in my head. I know there's many other things that make a conservative, but it was very
which
much
I think about. in isolation makes complete sense, and I completely understand why people think that way. But it's the same in France, by the way. We have that sentiment as well, even in very left-leaning France. So it's not, you know, pointing fingers.
I think the problem comes is when you suddenly see there are people who can't work for what they want. And it's the elderly, it's people with disabilities, it's people who have long-term illness, things like that, that you start to realize, hold on a second, you know, life's not black and white. There are many different aspects to everyone's life. But still, you know, I was still in the UK, I was still there, and I would see some of the parents of these special needs kids and think, wow, you know, the kids have got it bad, but these parents should be doing better for them. I don't know why I had that attitude, but I sort of thought, well, it took a while for me to sort of turn around and say, I think it was until I had kids, actually, and then I realized how difficult the job is for me to suddenly turn around. And actually, I'll fast forward a few years, because I think I went through, I wasn't very politically leaning in the 2000s, sort of, where were we? It was about 2001. I was just after 9/11 that I came to the UK. And then it was until about 2009 when I met my current wife, Claire, and we decided, well, let's try going back to Zimbabwe to make a life there. And I'd always thought, I'm going to go back there. It's going to be wonderful. You know, I still hadn't seen the bubble I'd been living in up to that point. Even though I'd lived in the UK and I'd worked my ass off. I'd worked in London as a business analyst, and, you know, I'd bought a house, and I was, by all accounts, doing well, car and all that. When you live in London, owning a car is a big thing. So I wasn't, you know, well off, but I was well off enough to be able to afford a trip to Zimbabwe every couple of years, off my own back, etc., which is, you know, a fair thing, plus pay for all the nice sky and computers and all that. So anyway, you must stop me if I'm rambling, Joe.
No, it's fine. Keep going. But so you go back to Zimbabwe?
We went back to Zimbabwe. My wife and I, Claire, we went back. And initially, there was a lot of optimism. And I'm not going to, this isn't to go into Zimbabwean politics, but I think ultimately after a couple of years there, I realized, hold on a second, I actually had it pretty good in the UK. The biggest thing I had was access to the NHS, and it slowly took me time to realize it, because if I had any kind of issue, I had to go to the doctor, and if I didn't have cash, you know, there were all sorts of issues. And it wasn't so much throwing me out of the doctor's surgery, because they knew me, but it cost money every time you went to the doctor, and that to me was just foreign. From being in the UK for almost 10 years, I sort of thought, well, you know, why am I paying to see a doctor? You know, I didn't realize then that it was completely against what I'd been thinking, if you know what I mean. So,
right. So you realized you had become kind of in favor of an institution like the national healthcare system.
Yeah.
But you hadn't realized before it was taken away, kind of?
Well, yeah, and the thing is also is that I'm always into maths and stats, and one of the things I started to look at was, well, okay, I pay I'm very anti-insurance as a whole. I think insurance is negative gambling. I think it's, I don't know, people might very disagree with me, but I think insuring things is one of the biggest wastes of money. But I'm very pro national health insurance. So it's interesting because...
Yeah, that's strange that you're anti-insurance. Yeah. So why are you pro?
Well, the thing is, when you look at private insurance, at least the way it's presented in Zimbabwe, there's all sorts of competing companies for insurance, and we looked into getting it for a while, and one of the biggest things was, you know, you pay in for a year, but you can't claim any services for that first year, etc., or you can't claim certain services and pre-existing conditions. We know that term now, don't we? And you know, that sort of thing. If you have any pre-existing conditions that included mental health issues, they wouldn't cover you for certain things, but yet you'd still pay the same amount into the insurance. And what it worked out to is, we would be paying more to private insurance companies than we were to the national health, than we were paying collectively to the NHS here. So just very quick sums, you know, we suddenly saw, well, we're paying more money for private health in Zimbabwe than we were for the national health contributions we paid in the UK. And
that's a common, I mean, I think even the people in the US who don't like the single payer the single payer system, know and understand that you're going to be paying more to insurance companies than you are to, a single payer, but at least you choose whether or not you want to, and still, I'm keep going.
The upshot of it was that we realized that we couldn't afford to pay for insurance, medical insurance. So we thought, well, look, you know what? We won't pay for it, but we'll pay for individual things. So when we went to the doctor, we'd pay $50 US dollars a shot, you know, every time the doctor saw us, etc. Yeah. And then, you know, it worked out to be cheaper for us to do it that way, and that was a choice we made in the situation we were in. But one thing we weren't prepared for was that when we decided we want to have children, we realized that in order to get covered to have that child, we would need to be insured for a whole year before we initially got pregnant. I don't know if that works that way in America, but
I'm hoping not. But
but that's the way the insurance companies work. They say, you know, if you're looking to get pregnant, they wanted us to be on their books for a year,
right?
So that we don't just start paying insurance just to get pregnant, because the cost for a normal pregnancy, straight out the box, no problems whatsoever. That was a very unfortunate way of putting it. it worked out to $5,000. Now, I was making about $1,500 a month in Zimbabwe. So $5,000.
That's a significant.
Just for a normal pregnancy and no complications. That's assuming there's no complications. I think it was one or two nights in the hospital at the most, maybe just one. Mm. And we thought, wow, okay. My personal situation, and I'm filtering it out just for my personal situation with healthcare. Now I'll expand in a bit, but my personal situation was like, okay, well maybe we should have taken insurance 2 years ago, but we haven't, and now we're in a situation where Claire got pregnant, and we thought, wow, we either have to scrape this money together, or look into our choices,
I think this illustrates one of the issues with not having compulsory insurance for everyone. And that's something I tried to say in the previous episode. You don't know what's going to happen to you. Yeah. And you make choices. It's really making choices that are not good for you. And the argument is for some people, well, then if you're an idiot, you have a right to be an idiot. But really, it's not that simple. I mean, it's you're playing with people's health here. And and some people said, but of course you're going to get the care you need. They can't throw you out the hospital. First of all, they'll treat for the immediate issue. And we've gotten a couple of very poignant replies and comments on this. They'll treat you for the immediate thing. They'll get you out the door, but then you're not going to get the actual long-term treatment you need. And on top of that, it's a hit for the hospital is one of the things that people kept saying. And it's a hit for the hospital. Where do you think the money comes from afterwards? They're going to make other patients pay more, to compensate for that. So it's not a good system. But can you finish, but let's get back to how it works in the UK and Europe afterwards, which you're comparing.
I'll go back to just the way I think Zimbabwe is a little harsher than it would be in the US. I think there's more backup systems in the US. But in Zimbabwe, it is literally if you cannot pay for the private health, you go into the public health system, which as you can imagine, is not that great. It hasn't been that well supported, and can be an issue. So I
want to talk about how the public system works in Europe, at least my experience in France, because I want to dispel a few misunderstandings or wrong ideas. But we'll get into that.
We can definitely go into that. That was my experience, and I know people listening are going to say, like you say, oh, well, should have planned ahead and should have made this and should have done that.
Hey, this is Zimbabwe.
But I think it illustrates to me the having to get health insurance. It's like you said in the last one when you talked about car insurance. People are forced to pay car insurance because it might affect someone else. And this is the issue, was that we got pregnant. Now, it's not that child's fault that me as a parent decided not to get health insurance. It's not that child's fault. It's not my son's fault that I'm an idiot. But it's them who are going to suffer the consequences if something goes wrong in the pregnancy, most likely. That child's the one who's going to have the issues. And I've seen it in Zimbabwe where somebody is in a car crash or somebody has a health issue that's nothing to do with their life choices. You might argue any number of things are to do with their life choices, but they're then in a situation where they desperately need health care. They desperately need to go to hospital and they don't. And they end up either dying, which happens, it was mentioned that people aren't just left to die, but somebody who is old, maybe 60, 70, sitting in their home thinking, oh, I've got a bit of a pain in my chest there. Well, I'm not going to go to the doctor or the hospital because I don't want to have to pay all the money. So he's just going to sit there in his chair, and 24 hours later, somebody will come by and realize, you know, the poor guy's died of a heart attack, which could
either
have
that or, you know, long-term illnesses or something. You should get treated, you don't. Or I mean, it really feels like we're being, I think some people are going to hear this and hear, well, they're being overdramatic. We're really not. We're really not. And I don't think I can convince anyone. All we can do is say, this is the experience we have. Yeah. And to get back to that, I think some people will think, well, you know, it's too, I think the two misunderstandings or false ideas is it's too expensive and it doesn't work.
Okay. The two things I'd say there, if we come to the, so we come back to the UK, Claire and I decided one of the reasons was because of the NHS. And we thought, you know what, there's a good system here and it works. And we're both UK citizens, so we're eligible for it, etc. And it does work and it is affordable. It's just...
I just want to mention, it is affordable for the country.
Yes.
For everyone, of course, but for the country. Healthcare is less expensive when you have a single payer system. And you know the numbers, so I'm sure you can attest to that. Obvious. It is. It just is.
It is, any way you look, you will find the numbers on the internet. It is cheaper to have a single payer system where everyone contributes. It's not about insurance companies. We don't. This is something that was missed, I think, in your last episode. One of your guests was saying, well, you know, insurance companies pull out and there's a disaster. Well, there shouldn't be insurance companies involved. It's not up to an insurance company to be giving someone care or money for care. It should be all under a national health service that's managed. So the money goes directly to the health service and then they use it as and when they see fit. Now, there could be many things you could pick apart. And living in Scotland, I'm quite lucky because our national health system is actually doing quite well compared to in England. They're having shortages there, and dare I say it, Brexit has caused a lot of issues with staffing. It's also causing issues with staffing in the care sector here. Don't get me started on that. I'll go off that. But it is affordable, and I had the figures here, but they're not here. For the actual healthcare. I don't know if you're interested in knowing the different...
Sure, you can give us a couple of figures just to illustrate, but...
I've lost the document, Patrick, but carry on.
Yeah, so the fact that it works from a financial standpoint, I think, is difficult to dispute with any kind of seriousness. And we did make that point in the last episode. I think something that was mentioned a few times was in different forms was, but it doesn't work. You know, there's this big fiction that you don't actually get good healthcare in these kinds of systems, you know, with the idea that it's very slow and people from, you know, Canada come down to the US to get healthcare, which, no, it's not really that, you know. A few people might do it for specific procedures, or if they have a lot of money, they'll get in front of the line for some things. But overall, it's a mischaracterization to say Canadians want to get their healthcare in the US. I mean, there are probably a few instances of specific cases that you can throw at us. But if we talk about Europe, and if I talk about France, I think we need to understand what we say when we say it works. Are you going to get the best possible healthcare in the world for everyone in the country? No, absolutely not.
No.
That is, of course, not the case. So, you know, if you want the best healthcare in the world, you might, I'm guessing you will probably stay in France anyway, but you might want to go to a private clinic, which you're allowed to do. You know, you can do that. That you have private clinics and you can go there and get that kind of treatment. It doesn't prevent you. They don't disappear because you have national health system. What will happen, however, is that if you need something done, it will get done in the quote-unquote important care. So there are things that aren't covered by the regular national health care. Dental work is usually very poorly covered. Eyes work is very poorly covered. You'll get like, I don't know, 30 euros for a pair of glasses that will cost you $2,500. So that, of course, is a concern for some people. Dental work, as I said, if you need anything other than a cavity filled, it's going to cost you money. So I don't think anyone is pretending that the health system in Europe is paradisiac, right? Mm-hmm. It's not this magical thing where everything gets treated. However, if you have an illness or something you need to get looked at, you go to the doctor. We have private practitioners here in France. So you go to a private practitioner, you get it looked at. If you have, you need to see a specialist, they will refer you, you know, they'll tell you, you need to go see a specialist and you'll take another appointment with a specialist. That's all private. So you will get those relatively quickly. And we have conventions. So the prices are set to what the national health system, the social mm-hmm. security, will reimburse. So for they will pay you, I don't know, 20 euros for a generalist, and the generalist might charge you a little bit more. You'll get reimbursed of the 20 euros, or it will be paid directly, and you'll pay the rest if you choose to go to a doctor that is more expensive. But you can very easily find a doctor that isn't. And maybe, okay, I'll take the, you know, angry route. Maybe they're not the best doctor in the world, but they're still a doctor, and they're most likely going to find out what's wrong with you. And then you go to a hospital if you have a specific procedure you need to get done. And if it's not super urgent, then yes, maybe you're going to have to live with some discomfort for a few weeks or a few months until, you know, they can fit you in. That's true. Is the hospital going to be the most high-tech, wonderful place you've ever seen? Some of them might be good. Some of them might be a little bit depressing, but they will treat you, and they will treat you well. That is, I think, something that is, you know, misunderstood. Mm-hmm. They will treat you very well. You will get your issue resolved. And if they don't find what's wrong with you, they'll run the tests, and they'll run as many tests as they need to until they find what's happening, if you wish to, you know, continue the thing. If you want to be reimbursed more, if you want to get extra, you know, insurance, you can get what's called a mutuelle, which is basically like an insurance company, but heavily, heavily regulated. And you will pay for that mutuelle, I don't know, anything from 5 to a few dozen euros. And it will cover more of what you get. They will get into dental. They will get into providing you, for example, for paying for a TV if you need to stay in a hospital, or, you know, these kinds of things. Paying for a private room if you need to stay in a hospital. The less essential things that you can get extra insurance for, but they're incredibly heavily regulated. So they have specific rules, prices, types of thing they can or cannot do. So you have that dual system in France. And as someone who's had to take advantage of it a few times, in some cases, in some dire circumstances, you would think that the price of those procedures would make the system unsustainable. And that it would make the prices explode. And certainly there are some questions about how balanced the budget is. But it's not like it's it's not like we're paying for everyone to go to the moon every year, right? It is mm-hmm. possible to put together if you arrange a few things here and there. And you would think, with all the things I had done to me, it would make it not possible for the system to work. But it really does in that way. It's not perfect, but if you're sick, you just go to the doctor. And like you said, Bruce, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry, oh my God, you know, I don't have enough money this month to go mm-hmm. to the doctor. I'll go next month or
yeah.
these kinds of things. So I don't know if I'm painting a good enough picture of the French system, but can you get back to, you were saying you sort of changed your mind about it, and so you think it works in the UK too?
It does. I mean, the UK system is, I was actually looking, just comparing, France has got a higher rate of private insurance schemes than the UK. In fact, it's one of the highest in Europe, from what yeah. I could see here. But
because of that dual system, the private yeah. insurance are very almost everyone has that thing. But as I said, it's a few dozen euros or so per person, and it is incredibly regulated. They don't do what they want at all. Just to emphasize this again.
Well, the doctors over here are pretty much, they have a contract with the NHS, the GPs and everything. I don't know the finance side of the NHS side, but I know it's mostly paid by government financed expenditure. I think in France is more of a compulsory insurance, which be more along the lines of the single payer system. But ultimately, I think it works out to the same thing, whether it's a compulsory insurance or the national health. I pay money into national insurance every month anyway. It's a sort of a compulsory tax. It's an extra tax, so it's the same thing.
Yeah, we do that on our salaries, basically. Yeah, you get a yeah. significant amount. I can't remember how much, but it's, I don't know, maybe 10-20% of your salary goes away in and your salary and your employer also has to pay. So yeah. I don't think anyone's saying it's cheap.
No, it's not. But if you start looking at the actual figures, and I'll give you the link so you can put it on the show notes, but there's a very good visual here of how the current healthcare expenditure is as a percentage of GDP for the G7 countries as a whole. And you see that the USA spends a lot more money on healthcare than.
Can you give us the figure?
Well, in the USA alone, it's 16. I'm just looking at the graph. I don't have the actual numbers, but it's just over 16% of healthcare expenditure
of
GDP, whereas in the UK it's below 10%. In France it's just under 11%. And in fact, when you look at government compulsory expenditure, the governments in the USA are paying along the same amount of lines as the European countries per person. The deficit is made up by private and voluntary expenditure. So the people who are paying for it is not the government. The government's not paying extra in the USA. It's the actual people getting the services. When you start to really drill down into it, it's not. And this is the issue, and I think a lot of people think, well, if we're all paying into it, then we're paying for people who don't want it. Well, this is what's happening with insurance. Insurance is exactly the same thing, except the insurance companies are betting. They're using you as a racehorse. Yeah, you are a racehorse. They're betting that you are not going to fall over and need money. But in order to do that, they need to put the odds in their own favor. So they will work the odds to say, right, you have to pay this amount of money so that we make money out of you in the long run. So the system is inherently, and this is why I'm anti-insurance as a commercial enterprise, because the system is inherently pushed against you. It's inherently saying, we're betting against you, and they have the force of. My father wanted me to go into actuary when I first came out of school.
What's that?
Actuarial work, and I'm sure somebody will probably get me to clear this up on me. But basically, it's somebody who looks at statistics and looks at numbers, and then tells the insurance companies what the odds are. This is a very simplistic view. Tells insurance what the odds are and says, right, okay, this is what you should set your prices at if you want to get a profit out of this.
So on the NHS, there is no private entity that is involved.
Well, you can get private healthcare, but you have to pay for it. And I was lucky enough when I lived in London, and I think it's a reason why the penny didn't drop for me too much then, was I was on Bupa, which is a private health insurance. And
That come on top of the NHS, or does it replace it?
It's on top of it. The company I worked for paid for it, and I would get things like physio paid for. You know, I had problems with my back. I still do, but it was all paid for. I'd go to a private physio. I'd get the appointment straight away, and you know, it was wonderful. You know, it's great to have that, but it was all paid for, and it was an extra monthly thing. It was one of my job perks, but once I couldn't pay for it, I'm not missing it. Not like I missed the NHS when I left the country, if you know what I mean.
How does the NHS work? Do you go to a private GP do you go to a hospital? Do you have to wait for 3 weeks before you get into a doctor's office? Or?
No, at the moment, it's probably about, if you need to see a GP, if it's not urgent, you can see them within the week. And that's a normal doctor. Now, each area, the NHS splits the United Kingdom into different, the word's gone out of my head at the moment. Into different areas. Yeah. I've completely forgotten the word, but like where I am now, I'm up in Scotland. I'm in a partnership who are part of the wider health and so wider NHS. Hold on, I'm going to look up the word while I'm here, because this is a problem with.
So do you go to a doctor's like private office? Because here in France, they have like offices in regular apartments. They're not gathered together in clinics or hospitals. You can go, like, they have an apartment, they have a cabinet, which is an office, and you go into a private building, go to the third floor, ring a bell, and someone comes open the door, and you get into it, and they have like their equipment, of course. But so it's completely quote unquote private, and they often get together four or five or six people to get an apartment and furbish it for that kind of thing. But yeah, that's how it works. You don't necessarily need to go to the
for the
basic stuff, of course. But
The way the NHS is, the way the health primary healthcare is set up here, is that the doctors are set up in health centers mostly. They will have purpose built buildings. Sometimes they'll be in situations like that, but there will be places that are funded by the NHS, from what I understand. Now, this could change within different health boards. So I am assigned to a certain GP when I move into an area. So by my postcode, I'm assigned. So I need to phone that GP when I need something. I don't know how different that is, but there's a certain...
So how that person specifically, you can't open the phone book, find a doctor, and go to see them, which is what we can do in France.
Well, I would assume I would possibly...
But you need to pay them. The NHS is not going to pay for it.
If I'm on holiday... And this has happened before I actually moved up to Scotland, when I came to visit, I needed to see a GP, and they will see you, and it'll be free of charge, but they will have to get your records from down in England, where I was, etc. Okay. And there's all sorts of data protection issues there. So yes, it is possible. I mean, I could.
So why are you assigned one GP then? Is it just...
It's for ease of...
Administrative stuff.
It's not. It's
can
not
you change if you don't like that person? Can you request a change?
It's not the GP I'm assigned to. Sorry, it's not the GP. I'm assigned to a practice. to the practice as a whole. So in that practice, like where I am, there's about 7 or 8 GPs, and I can request to see a certain one, but that may mean it takes a bit longer to be seen by a doctor. Or I can just see whoever's available. I also have a system of, they call it out of hours, where you can phone out of hours, and there'll be a doctor on call who will give you advice, or there'll be a nurse who can give you advice. We've used that before with my son, where he's had a certain reaction. They'll say, okay, do this and this. If you don't, you need to take him to A&E, which is accident and emergency, or you know, you take him to the hospital. And that's the other thing. So we have these GP practices that are scattered around the countryside, and then there will be a main hospital which will be used almost as a center, and that hospital is then, that's where we went to, you know, they've got a maternity ward there, they've got a children's ward, they've got a mental health ward, they've got different hospitals that have different things. For certain things, we have to go through to Aberdeen, which is a 2-hour drive away, and you know, that was for the Royal, that's the children's hospital specifically, you know, if there's long-term issues and that sort of thing. So not all hospitals will have everything, but most will have the basics you need there. And then they're referred to by the GPs.
Let's say you get, you know, a pain in your chest and you go to your GP, he runs a few tests, he sends you to a specialist maybe. So for us, the GP will refer you to a specialist, as I said, and the specialist, you can take an appointment in a hospital, but you can also go see a private person that will, and it will be reimbursed, and that private person will also be working in a cabinet, and they will you know, receive you in a regular building in Paris. So it's not like hospital type centers. And if you need a procedure or long term something, they can refer you to a hospital. You will go there. In the UK, if you need, you have a pain in your chest, go see your GP. He says, okay, you need, you know, a procedure done or long term treatment, like medical treatment. Do they refer you to a hospital, or do you?
I think it would entirely depend on the the nature of what you've got. If you've got, I've had a personal experience where I've gone in and my son had an issue, and the GP then, he saw us right away. We went in, it was sort of, it was almost after hours, and the GP saw us and said, okay, right, he's not happy with what he's seeing. He referred us immediately to the hospital. So we then had, you know, we then drove my son to the hospital, which is about
2 hours away.
Oh, no, this was the smaller hospital. It's not a small hospital. It's the hospital we have in our area. And they then saw him there. And it was only later on that he needed to be moved to the bigger hospital where they've got the specialist care. And it was a specialist unit for what he had. And it was a very unusual circumstance. So he was taken there by ambulance. So, you know, it was...
How did you pay for this?
Didn't pay anything at all.
Right.
Nothing at all. And in fact, we had to stay a couple of nights in Aberdeen, which is about 2 hours drive from here. And I was fully prepared to pay for a hotel for us to stay overnight there while he was in hospital. And there was a charity that actually paid for rooms within the children's hospital for us to stay in.
So privately funded.
It was privately funded charity, but one of us was allowed to stay in the hospital room with my son. Mm. So we didn't pay a thing for this. The ambulance ride, we didn't pay anything for. Nothing at all, because it's all covered under the NHS Grampian, which is the health board that covers our area.
So I had, you know, experiences with hospitals recently. My dad was very ill over the past year. And for those who don't know, he passed away a few months ago. And so he was in and out of hospitals for very serious conditions over the past, especially the last 6 to 3 months of his life. And we would go there to the hospital, get into the room. He would get a private room. It was a really great hospital. And we would pay for internet. I think TV might have been included, or we would pay for that as well. So it came to, you know, a few dozen euros a week. But also, if we needed an ambulance, they would it would be paid for, you know. And he would come from very far away. We didn't take advantage of it because, you know, he wanted to drive and he wanted to be driven. But we could have. And again, this was, and this is, you know, I'm always hesitant to, I know people think there is, there are these dingy, horrible hospitals with people who don't care about you. And I did mention sometimes they might not be incredibly beautiful hospitals. And it's true. I'm sure there are some which have, you know, some people that have less than optimal experiences. But for us, the hospital was amazing. And the people were so caring. And the you know, the care was world class. It was...
I can only mirror that, Patrick. I think the nurses and the doctors that I've dealt with within the NHS have all been absolutely fantastic. You know, that they are people who are doing, if I believed in God, I would say it's God's work. But, you know, it's they're doing work that is just completely, it's amazing. And the facilities and, also, you know, we're not I live up in the sticks in Scotland, up in the rural areas, and we've got equipment up here. We can, sure, it's a 2-hour drive to get to Aberdeen for the specialist children's hospital, but you know, we've got everything we need up here. There's only very few procedures that can't be taken up, can't be done in the hospitals that are nearby. And this is all funded for by the government. This is all funded for by our tax money, if essentially, because that's what our national insurance payment is. It's a slight increase in tax.
And, you know, to just put another element to this, because I really want to make sure people listening understand this. We would see a specialist, I think by the end it was, you know, a few times a month. And we would drive all the way to Paris. My parents lived far away. And we would see a specialist and we would get to the hospital and it wasn't fun. And we would wait sometimes in the waiting room a couple of hours because that it was a cancer, oncologist. Mm-hmm. And they would it would be late. You know, we had an appointment for... I'm really trying to paint a picture of what it actually is. So we would have an appointment for 2 p.m. and we wouldn't get in, you know, we wouldn't see her until 3:30 or something like that. So it wasn't fun, cancer patient waiting in the waiting room with sometimes a couple of other people. But the waiting room wasn't ugly. It was not, you know, it was kind of enjoyable, but of course it's not a fun experience. And I don't think hospitals aren't fun, but she was really, and it wasn't just that doctor. All of the doctors were so caring. When my dad ended up passing away, I sent her main oncologist, his main oncologist, I sent her a thank you note for how patient and understanding and all of it she was. And everyone at the hospital, you know, we have an image of hospitals with, you know, the overweight nurse that will throw stuff on your table and like be like, oh, you do this, and doctors that don't take the time to listen to you. The doctors would take time out of their rounds, you know, to come sit down, listen to my dad when, you know, 2 years ago when it wasn't as critical, listen to him, hear what his problems were, like actually sit down and listen. Just if they knew there wasn't a lot they could do or like just listen to him. And they were like interns, like actual doctors who would do that. And the reason I'm talking about this is that I want to emphasize the quality of the care we're getting, because I've said a number of times, yeah, you know, it might not be the best, it might, and it's not necessarily always the best, but it's also, there is high quality care as well, and overall. So I really want to make that clear.
You might not be having the Rolls-Royce service for every single person, but you're at least you're getting a taxi for everyone. And this is kind of how I say it to everyone. It's, you know, you're not having somebody being picked up by a limo every day, but you're getting them picked up at least, and you're getting them on their feet. And at least the guy who's driving the car is a friendly guy, and it's a clean car. And, it, you know, if I was to take an analogy, I think that would be one that I would use. And I think people who pay for insurance, for the impression I've gotten, I haven't got any experience with the American system, but I think there's an expectation there that the more you pay, the better it is, you know, and that's insurance as well as anything. And my experience, at least in Zimbabwe, is that's not the case. And this is something else I wanted to go and say, is that when you're paying for insurance for things, it's very easy, and I have seen it. I've seen it done, and I'm sure I'd like to hear if this is experience of people in America, but where people have been told by the insurance company, sorry, you're not covered for that condition.
Even I think that's pretty common knowledge.
Yeah, it does happen. You've paid in all this money your whole life, but actually we're not going to cover you for that. And they'll leave you to have to pay for it. Now, that doesn't happen under the NHS. What you might have is slightly longer waiting times for certain things. You know, there's a big target in the UK that A&E at the moment is the big one, where people are have to be seen within 4 hours when they get to the A&E service, and Scotland's doing better than England in that, and some health boards are doing better than others, and some could be managed better than others, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when we're talking about figures in the 90s, that's 9 out of 10 people are seen within 4 hours. And in fact, my experience, wherever I've been, is I'm seen within 10, 15 minutes when I go to an A&E department, and they are clean and well-kept areas. So I can only, and I hate to make this sound like an echo chamber, but I can only back up what you're saying in your experience in France, is that the doctors, the nurses have always been good, the equipment's good. And in fact, I will link you this website, and just because it gives some good high level figures. It's on from the Scotgov. It's the main statistical information. You can get it from the government. And if you have a look at life expectancy in the USA and you map that against health spending per capita, you can see in America that people live, I think, just under 79 years as a health expectancy, and they spend £6,000 per capita. £6,000 per capita in the USA, and their life expectancy is 79. Whereas in the UK, we're just under 3,000. And life expectancy is 82%, just under 82, say 81 to be think. So, you know, that to me gives an indication that, hold on, you know, somewhere, if you look at this graph, the American system, there's something going on there. It's a massive outlier. It's way out. It's lower than the ones, you know, you got ones that are life expectancy is almost up to 84, and the most they'll pay is up to £5,000 per capita, whereas the USA is well over six. That's not well over 6,000. Actually, it is. Sorry, the line's a bit thick, but it's well over 6,000, and they're under 80. So you know that there's something going on there in America. There's something there where, and the money for me is not going towards making people better. That's what I see when I look at the numbers. This is. You can come and talk to me, and I will talk about the failures in NHS that need to be addressed. I think there's also.
Can we talk about this for just a second, just for the sake of?
I think there's too much politics involved. That's the opposite end of it being a government.
You know, in what sense?
The government, for me, and this is my statistical side of it, is they will focus on a certain number of measures. They will sort of say, like a big one we've got at the moment, they call it bed blocking. It's delayed discharges. It's when people are in hospital, and this is where I work in health and social care. They're in hospital, they finish their treatment, they're due to be discharged, and they then have, you know, they need a care plan to take them home. so that they can live at home. So they need a carer twice a day to do this and that. And that's all done by the social work side of it. And sometimes there's a tension there between health and social care, in that health might say somebody's discharged when they shouldn't be and is ready for discharge. And there's all kinds of political things around that. But what the government will do is they will look at one figure. So they will say, for the month, you've had 14 people who were over 2 weeks delayed discharge. You know, what's going on here? This is terrible. They will focus on that, whereas they could have some other area that's been completely ignored that really needs to be looked at. Like from my perspective, it would be things like preventative care and things like that, you know. And that's another thing that you touched on when you were talking to the guys, is that a lot of the benefits we get is from preventative spending. A lot of the things we get are from, sorry, I've gone back into benefits again. I'll go. So that'll be it. And then we get government funding cuts. They'll cut certain areas. They'll move money around, etc. But then there's also, and I don't want to go into it too much, but like I said, internal politics between how doctors, GPs see the hospitals, and we have big problems with data sharing between the different systems. Right. You may have to explain your problem to 7 or 8 different people along the way. Because they're not allowed to share data between them. And then there's also waiting times are another thing. I think I don't have the figures on American waiting times. I wouldn't know what they're like. But we have issues here with some of our practices because of the way they are and the population and the pressures they have. You may have to wait a couple of weeks to see a doctor if your query isn't urgent, you know, if something isn't urgent. But then in saying that, you can go to A&E, and one of the issues that's happened is that too many people have gone to A&E for things they shouldn't do because there's the doctors. Anyway, there can be pressures on the system when people see it as a free service, they will then take advantage of it too much, and that puts pressure on it that doesn't need to be there. So there's an educating that needs to happen, and I think that's happening. And it's
well,
not perfect.
I would say, I would say I'm sure maybe it's happening. Let's say it isn't, you know?
Okay.
It's still a better overall system than what we see in countries that don't have single payer. Yep. And I think a lot of the arguments against single payer end up creating a system that is worse for everyone. Unless, you know, I don't know, if you have lots of money anyway, it's not, there is this fiction that, you know, if you have lots of money, you're not going to care. You're going to get the healthcare you need no matter what. Yeah. And maybe you're even going to go to professional doctors anyway, and you're not going, you know, not professional, I mean like private doctors anyway, and you're not going to care about the single payer. I don't, in France, I don't think it's very much the case. I think the large majority of people go to, everyone goes to the regular systems. Maybe you're going to choose a doctor differently, but ultimately, if you have something really serious, you're going to go to the hospital, unless you're like, I don't know, a billionaire or something. But there's this idea that if you're struggling or if you're a medium income family, then having a single payer system is going to make your life more difficult because you're going to pay for stuff that you don't need. Yeah. And I don't know how to explain it, or I don't think we should repeat it even again, but that's just not true. You're gonna, yes, you might not need it for 3 years, but then out of the blue you're gonna need it, and if you don't have it, you're effed. And we shouldn't make this into convincing again, but
I think it's just a question of what I would say to people is experience it. And one of the things you brought up in the last thing, and I was shouting down in the car while I was listening to it, was like, because it's not a question of, it can't just be a half-assed thing. And it sounds like this is what Obamacare is. I could be wrong, but it needs to be everyone involved. And it's not socialism. It's not communism. We're not, you know, we're not people here who are bleeding heart liberals. I think.
Well, I might be. Apparently, you're not.
Well, I don't know. I might be. I think I'm going more and more left as I get old. I don't know. I'm one of the strange people. I'm starting to believe in universal income now. So, that's. but that's a different story altogether.
Yeah, it is an interesting idea. I will get you give you that.
But yeah, I don't know what more to say. It works, Patrick.
That's kind of what it is. It works.
It works for the people who need it. And yes, there are always going to be problems. But even if you just look at the simple figures, people live longer in the UK and we pay less. We pay less out of our pockets. The government pays less overall.
So per person. If we can, we're getting close to the end of it. If we can go into just for a few minutes, you did mention a few times that you have changed your views on some of the things, and part of it was because of your experiences with national healthcare. Can you tell us a little bit more what it was like to, you know, realize that what you thought, and I think that applies not just to liberals or conservatives or, you know, healthcare or anything. I really want to hear about that experience for you of realizing that you thought something and that you had changed your mind about it, about something that was core to your identity, because I think that's something that is really important for us politically in the world today.
I think for me, it's about taking in and seeing what's out there and seeing what the evidence is. It's difficult. It's one of the hardest things in the world, I think, to look at yourself and realize, hold on, what I'm thinking here is wrong. What I'm thinking here is not the right way. It's not what should be. And I can understand why people don't like it. It's interesting that any company you ever go to, anytime they get a new senior manager, they'll go through a series of how to understand change. And they'll tell you about the mouse that stole my cheese. I don't know if you've heard of that book, but every time.
I don't
time.
Remember exactly what it is, but I've heard that story a few times.
I've seen it so many times that, you know, they bring that out. And change is difficult. But I think in the world, especially as it is right now, we need to be open. And for me, that's always been my issue. And doubting myself can be, it's a double-edged sword. You know, sometimes you look at yourself and think, right, maybe I'm not right here, but sometimes you're not. I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of a.
No, I think you've expressed it, but keep going.
I think the thing for me, the turning point is for me in my life was going back to Zimbabwe. Was also starting to, and I'm going to plug another podcast here, Patrick. But I think there's two things in my life that have helped me, and one is listening to, and I mentioned it in the email to you as a skeptic's guide to universe. It's suddenly seeing these people who were trying to be it's almost the opposite of what you're doing, apolitical as possible. What they will do is they will say, what is the evidence? What are the facts? Right. What does the science tell us? And, you know, how what does that mean for us as humans, et cetera, et cetera. And I used to believe in ghosts until I ran a ghost hunting company for 6 months.
And
I had to stop eventually because I realized I was conning people. There was nothing there, you know. So, you know, that was an example of, like, okay, I'm going to go out and see what there is. And I was like, oh, there's nothing actually here. There's nothing, you know.
What's really interesting in what you're talking about is that it echoes something that we discussed a while back. It was, who was it with? I can't remember. Anyway, so we ended up saying it is the important thing is that you experience something.
Yeah.
Oh, it was with Wendy.
Yeah.
The way people change their mind is by experiencing it. And I have to say, I have, if only it, when we're talking about this show, my mind was very set on Trump voters. you know, yeah. until I actually took the time to talk to them or to talk to one or two. And I realized, okay, maybe I'm not, you know, it wasn't easy to change my mind about all of this. I still have very strong opinions about mm-hmm. many of those things, including, you know, Donald Trump himself. But the things you mentioned in passing, the idea of universal income.
Yep.
It sounds ludicrous when you first hear about it. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous. And if you hear about it a little bit more, I'm not saying it's great. I think it's interesting. But yep. going from F you idiot, like freaking communist moron.
Yeah.
From at the beginning. And it takes a little bit of effort to listen and to think about it. And at first, when you start seeing, well, maybe your first reaction is to reject it. It's like, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and experiencing it, you're right, is the best way. So basically what we're saying is that we should all subsidize Americans who don't believe in healthcare to come to Europe and experience it for themselves for a year.
Yep.
Let's do that. Just to help the US. I think that would be in keeping with our bleeding heart liberal ethos.
You need a few more Patreon supporters than you can fund it.
So in the spirit of that, I think, well, we're going to get to the end of the episode and talk about Patreon for a second. Mm-hmm. But is there anything else you want to say before we close the
thing? I just wanted to say thanks for, you know, giving this voice. And like I said before, if anyone wants to challenge anything I've said, please do. It's what I think it's our duty as humans to challenge ourselves and challenge each other with respect. And I think the Phileas Club is a wonderful spot for that. So whether it be on the, you know, Phileas Club, become a patron and we can chat on the in the Patreon board or via Twitter. I just don't like being called nasty names. You know, don't call me.
No, I think in general. The community for the Phileas Club is incredibly respectful.
Yeah,
that's something I very much appreciate. So, thank you very much, Bruce. I will, of course, have your Twitter mm-hmm. account linked in the show notes. I would, of course, like to remind people that, as you mentioned, this show is funded much like the NHS efforts by the concerted efforts of the ones that are concerned by the show. So you can go to patreon.com/thephileasclub. The link is in the show notes, of course, and support the show. Again, like the NHS, you might think you don't need it, but really you do. And if you do, I would encourage you to let go of that one, you know, double frappuccino mocha latte if you're a New Yorker elite, or that, you know, that six pack of beer you were going to go buy at Target if you're in the Midwest, and just go and pledge just a few bucks per episode. That is how we change the world, one episode at a time and one contributor at a time. Well, maybe not change the world, but help open, you know, give interesting views to people around the world. So thank you very much to the many, many people who choose to donate a little bit of money to the show. I very much appreciate it. You know, I say it all the time, but it's very true. This show is a labor of love. And it feels incredibly rewarding and validating that you guys decide to give me a little bit of your hard-earned cash. And I might be a bleeding heart liberal, but by God, I'll take that cash and use it for stuff for me. So thank you very much in advance. My name is Patrick Beja. I'm Not Patrick on Twitter, Not Patrick on Facebook. The show is available at frenchspin.com. You can go there, comment, of course, Tell us what you think we got wrong, what you think we got right. You can leave a review on iTunes or other podcast catalogs. It is always a pleasure to get them, and it helps the show. And if you are interested in video games, you might be interested in Pixels, which is another show hosted at FrenchSpin.com. And we just had E3 go by, and that is the biggest gaming event of the year. And we had a giant episode summarizing all of it, and a bunch of other episodes where we were commentating on live on the press conferences, the many press conferences that we followed. But go check out Pixels. And the latest episode, number 61, where we summarize E3. And that was a blast. Did the episode with Scott Johnson. So go check that out as well. See, interesting stuff and entertainment. Well, I would venture the idea that Pixels is interesting as well, because we did analysis and explanation and geeking out, of course. So go check that out. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do let us know if you did or if you didn't, including on Twitter. And we will be back in a couple of weeks with a regular episode as usual. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again then. Bye.